I want to start with something that Franz Borkenau, an ex-German communist, wrote in 1938, in which he drew a picture of Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin, which still endures. He said, where Lenin, instead of the belief in the proletarian revolution, had put his hopes in a centralized party under his leadership, Rosa Luxemburg, almost alone, continued to believe in the proletariat. The masses must not be ordered about by an infallible central committee. They must learn from their own experience, their own mistakes. Revolution must be the result of their increasing political understanding. She believed, in short, in the spontaneity of the proletarian masses. And in 2007, Fredrik Jameson rounded out this picture when he casually referred to the authoritarianism and sectarianism of Lenin's party form. Now, these descriptions are caricatures which diminish the richness of the intellectual and activist achievements of both of these revolutionaries. And both of them stand head and shoulders above those who perpetrate these myths. The Mensheviks, for instance, who founded the lies about Lenin. And Luxembourg's admirers, who repeat them, dragging her down from the heights of an eagle, as Lenin called her, to the inconsequential dross of anarchism and liberalism. Now, I can't deal with every debate that Luxembourg and Lenin had. I'm just going to deal with those that are relevant to these caricatures. Spontaneity and the role of struggle in developing class consciousness, issues of organisation, and Luxembourg's critique of the Russian Revolution. So, the spontaneist and the authoritarian. Now, ironically, this characterization of them is the most misleading of everything because it's the issue on which they were actually the closest in their whole approach. A few passages illuminate how inspired they both were by spontaneous outbursts of struggle. And this was actually the question on which they, as I said, were the closest of any of the other debates. So Luxembourg on the mass strikes, which broke out in January 1905 after Bloody Sunday in Russia. The proletarian mass, counted by millions quite suddenly and sharply, came to realise how intolerable was that social and economic existence which they had patiently endured for decades in the chains of capitalism. Thereupon there began a spontaneous general shaking of and tugging at these chains, the passage that she's most famous for. And this is what Lenin wrote about these events. In the history of revolutions, there come to light contradictions that have ripened for decades and centuries. The masses, which have often been ignored and even despised by superficial observers, enter the political arena as active combatants. These masses are learning in practice, and before the eyes of the world are taking their first tentative steps, feeling their way, defining their objectives, testing themselves, and testing their ideological leaders. Now, Lenin, much earlier than Luxembourg, saw workers' spontaneous struggles as a foundational element of the revolutionary process. After involvement in strikes, mostly led by women textile workers, in 1899, he had already concluded, every strike reminds the workers that their position is not hopeless, that they're not alone. See what a tremendous effect strikes have both on the strikers themselves and on the workers at neighbouring or nearby factories or at factories in the same industry. In 1901, he wrote, the principal source that sustains revolutionary social democracy is the spirit of protest among the working class. So note, this spontaneity for Lenin is the principal source that sustains the revolutionary movement. Now, Luxembourg just doesn't appear to have had such a close involvement in workers' struggles in the 1890s, and so the mass strikes of 1905 affected her deeply. Here was the alternative for her to the stifling bureaucratic methods of the unions linked to the massive German Social Democratic Party of which she was a member. But she never added any insights on these questions which Lenin had not already drawn. And they both recognised in very similar terms the fundamental importance of such struggles in developing class consciousness and confidence. In 1899, Lenin had concluded, what a great moral influence strikes have, how they affect workers who see that their comrades have ceased to be slaves and, if only for the time being, have become people on an equal footing with the rich. In 1906, Luxembourg would write in the Maastricht, "The most precious, lasting thing in the rapid ebb and flow of the wave is the intellectual, cultural growth of the proletariat." So how can we explain why they're seen so differently? And I haven't just chosen my quotes. Well, a different context goes a long way to explaining it. Luxembourg is polemicising against the bureaucratic response by her party and the trade union leaders. And anarchists in particular can read the mass strike as supporting their hostility to a revolutionary party and the union bureaucracy. The caricature of Lenin, on the other hand, rests heavily on his polemics against the Economists in 1900 to 1901, with whom anarchists and reformists can sympathise. And Lenin, they sympathise with the Economists. So Lenin's phrase, kowtowing to spontaneity, is in one of his attacks on the Economists, is trotted out as irrefutable evidence of his disdain for the day-to-day struggles of workers. So we need to look briefly at what the debate was about. The Economists put all their emphasis on these immediate struggles and downplayed the need to build a revolutionary party. Lenin actually saw them as the Russian revisionists, similar to Bernstein in Germany, who had declared, "The final goal, no matter what it is nothing. The movement is everything." So this wasn't just a tactical question in his eyes any more than it was for Luxembourg in Germany against Bernstein. She had argued in her introduction to Reform or Revolution, "It is not a question of this or that set of tactics, but of the very existence of the social democratic movement." And Lenin writes, "Marxism linked up the economic and the political struggle of the working class into a single inseparable whole, and the effort to separate these forms of struggle is one of their most clumsy and deplorable departures from Marxism." And in these debates, Lenin developed a key aspect of his theory of revolution. To reduce the entire movement to the interests of the moment means to artificially break the link between the fully defined political strivings of the advanced workers and the spontaneous manifestations of protest on the part of the masses. So moving on, the idea that Luxembourg wasn't for a revolutionary party, as some people argue, is absolutely ludicrous. She put considerable effort into building a Polish socialist party. She fought within the SPD, the Social Democratic Party in Germany, to maintain it as the Marxist vanguard party that she thought it should be. Her books, Reform or Revolution, and The Mass Strike, The Political Party and the Trade Unions, were both interventions into that fight. And she was central to founding the KPD, the German Communist Party, in December 1918. However, her attack on Lenin in the debates about the split in the Russian Socialist Party into Bolsheviks and Mensheviks in 1903 is an enduring reference point for the caricature of Lenin. And to put it bluntly, her attack was shameful. She's oblivious to their radically different situation, with her fighting against the bureaucratized unions and the SPD leaders. And in Russia, the urgent task that Lenin was faced with was to establish some structure and rules as a basis to cohere a revolutionary organisation. And her essay, Organisational Questions of Social Democracy, is, as even some of her most sympathetic biographers admit, more a catalogue of the lies spread by prestigious Mensheviks than about the actual policies of Lenin. Now, in One Step Forward, Two Steps Back, Lenin had explained what the split was about, and the most important thing was that instead of the six-person editorial board of Iskra, the party paper, the conference voted for a committee of three, Plekhanov, Lenin and Martov, as proposed by Lenin. But afterwards, there was a huge fuss because the poor demoted editors were apparently very upset. And Martov, who'd been an ally of Lenin's during the conference, refused to sit on the committee, supporting their demand to remain on it. And after much wrangling, a new committee was set up from which Lenin, who had majority support at the conference, was excluded. All of this was a clear breach of the democratic decisions that had been taken by the party conference. And Lenin was outraged because he disliked this elevation of personal relationships over principled political alliances and positions. And he was determined that the party must have democratic structures to which the leadership, even more than the general members, must be accountable. Now, Luxembourg asserts that his summary of the conference issues is a methodological exposition of the ideas of the ultra-centralist tendency in the Russian movement. The viewpoint is that of pitiless centralism. And Lenin replies that he defends the principle that the rules adopted by a party congress must be adhered to until amended by a subsequent congress, and that he is indeed defending this basic principle of democracy intransigently. And Luxembourg attributes to Lenin the idea that the Central Committee is the only active nucleus of the party. And Lenin replies truthfully that he never advocated any such view, that in fact it was the Mensheviks who had inserted into the draft rules that he'd written that the Central Committee could direct local groups, and Lenin was never really for that. And he summarises the key questions that were at stake. I insisted that the conditions exist for expecting party congress decisions to be observed, and that the time was past when a party institution could be supplanted by a private circle. So it's trying to move people on from just, you know, hanging out with your friends and something like what we talk about the swamp today, and to form some serious organisation. And he scoffs at Luxembourg. Does the comrade consider it normal for party central institutions to be dominated by the minority of the party congress? However, this unwarranted attack on Lenin appears in an even worse light if we look at Luxembourg's role as a leader in the Polish party, of which he was a founding member, the Social Democracy of the Kingdom of Poland and Lithuania, which from now on will be the SDK-PIL. Now, Paul LeBlanc, a most sympathetic chronicler of Luxembourg's ideas, says that the SDK-PIL was hardly Luxembourgist in the libertarian way that the term is commonly understood. Indeed, and I can't go into it all, but an incredible example is in 1903 at that party congress of the Russians, Luxembourg's Polish party sent delegates to that conference with a mandate from the majority of their own conference to affiliate to the Russian party. And without explanation, without reference to party members, Luxembourg instructed them to leave the conference. Affiliation was off the table. Why? Because she read an article by Lenin on the rights of the national minorities to independence from the Russian Empire, which she didn't support. And she suspected that this harder position that she read would prevail over the less clear commitment in the party's draft program. So, and there's plenty of examples of Luxembourg being quite authoritarian. Now, Paul LeBlanc correctly says of Luxembourg's egregious accusations against Lenin that she's not arguing against a revolutionary party, as some think. He argues that she was warning of the danger of a small party degenerating into a sect incapable of leading a revolution. And then he comments that indeed Lenin's Bolsheviks did have a tendency to sectarianism. Example one, the infamous mistake by Bolshevik members in 1905 when the Mensheviks began setting up Soviets. They refused to participate unless the committees adopted the Bolshevik program. Now, a mistake in their first experience of revolution, which incidentally was corrected very quickly when Lenin worked out what they were doing, does not constitute an inherent tendency. But the practice of Luxembourg's Polish party was classically sectarian. In Poland, Stanisław Gut, a leader of the SDK-PIL in Warsaw, wrote in 1905 that if the proletariat today falls in battle, moving in separate groups rather than as a compact batch, we will be to blame and we will in the future have to answer seriously to history. And he proposed that they set up a council of workers' deputies, which will include representatives from all factories, plants and professions, and the representatives of all the socialist parties, in other words, a Soviet. But this proposal was denounced, and the party issued a leaflet declaring that the call for councils in Poland, quote, could only create confusion in the revolutionary ranks and harm the workers' cause. Councils couldn't unite the Polish workers' movement, the leadership argued, because the proletariat, quote, must have one program and one class party. And this was actually just what the Bolshevik members thought at first in 1905. Now, and in Russia it was corrected, in Poland it wasn't. Now, for years, while Luxembourg was writing polemics demanding that the Bolsheviks unite with the Mensheviks, she refused to even work with the PPS, the Polish Socialist Party, which was miles to the left of the Mensheviks. Driven by rigid hostility to the PPS, mainly, or at least largely, because they supported the demand for Polish national independence, Luxembourg and the other leaders in Poland, because she stayed involved in the party even when she was in Germany, again and again, they refused to work with the PPS in joint campaigns. In contrast, even when in 1901 workers rioted and Lenin didn't think that it was the best way forward, he argued for Bolsheviks to support them, arguing, "These outbursts arouse to conscious life the widest sections of the workers and stimulate in them a noble hatred for the oppressors and enemies of liberty." And unlike Luxembourg, Lenin theorized the role of the Soviets after 1905, and he concluded that the Soviet was, quote, "the representative of the interests of the entire mass of the poor, i.e. of 9/10 of the population." And he argued that they created a forum in which the masses could participate in debates and decisions about the struggle, just as Galton basically thought in Poland. And all parties and tendencies could and should put their arguments for debate in these councils. Now, LeBlanc's other example of the Bolsheviks' tendency to sectarianism is that Bolshevik intellectuals such as Bogdanov took up ultra-left sectarian philosophical positions after the 1905 revolution. And paradoxically, their expulsion for this sectarianism is also part of the mythology of Lenin, the intolerant sectarian. Actually, after 1905, once they reoriented to the repressive political situation, the Bolsheviks remained as open as possible while rebuilding an underground organization as well. But Lenin's opponents continued to accuse him of splitting the movement with his refusal to unite with other parties. In 1912, though, after, you know, 5 or 6 years of steady, systematic work, he proudly rebuts their slanders, showing that his strategy to build a party is succeeding. And this is what he writes: "Strange, is it not? The conciliatory, tolerant, united, non-splitting, broad-minded, non-dogmatic Narodniks, by their own admittance, conduct no insurance campaign, exercise no influence on the trade unions, and have no organized group in the Duma. But the dogmatic Marxists, who are forever splitting and thereby enfeebling themselves, have been able to carry out all of these, and what's more, they're supported by an obvious and unquestionable majority of the class-conscious workers." They've done a big survey of the papers that the workers contributed to and supported. In contrast, the SDK-PIL in Poland degenerated after 1905 into a genuinely bureaucratic, dogmatic sect. But leave aside Poland, Luxembourg had a tendency to ultra-left sectarianism towards the unions and lent towards abstention in elections. And she never developed as close an interaction with militant workers as Lenin. And one or two historians actually say she was quite isolated as the revolution began to break out at the end of 1918. And consequently, the new German Communist Party failed to win the allegiance of the revolutionary shop stewards, who constituted the most important vanguard of the workers in Berlin in particular. In contrast, Lenin's strategy and tactics in 1917 were the hallmark of united work with others while maintaining their principles. And the high point was the massive response that they organized to defeat Kornilov's attempted coup in August. They united Mensheviks, socialist revolutionaries, workers, and soldiers. It was a turning point in winning mass support in the Soviets for the Bolsheviks, and it's an example of what became known as the United Front. And they won the began to win majorities in the Soviets because they demonstrated in practice what their policies meant. So let's look at another common argument against Lenin, his idea of a vanguard party. This was part of the debate with Martov and the Mensheviks. Martov argued for a broad party, including, he said, every striker, every protester, the more widespread, the better. But Lenin disagreed. He said the less wavering there is within the party, the more varied, richer, and more fruitful will be the influence of the party on the masses surrounding it. And we've seen the results of that by 1912. The vanguard, Lenin argued, should not be confused with the whole working class. Now, Luxembourg was always less clear, at one time stating that the party is itself the proletariat. Yet in the mass strike, she contradicts it and says the Social Democrats are the most enlightened, most class-conscious vanguard of the proletariat. However, you know, even though I think that's what she ended up thinking, she never really grasped the essence of the role of the vanguard party. And the differences how she and Lenin explain it are instructive. There's all kinds of things we can talk about in the discussion, but this I wanted to take these passages out. Because that passage that I started from her continues. If the Social Democrats should seize and maintain the real leadership of a mass movement, should they become, in a political sense, the rulers of the whole movement, then they must, with the utmost clearness, consistency, and resoluteness, inform the German proletariat of their tactics and aims in the period of coming struggle. Now, actually, this could be written up as what is the caricature of Lenin, seizing the leadership, rulers of the movement who inform workers of their program. Just think of when Lenin returns to Russia. He spells out to the members how they will eventually convince workers that they need to seize power through the Soviets. He says, the sad experience of the new stage of the war will inevitably lead to the political downfall of the Socialist Revolutionary and Menshevik parties. The task of the Workers' Party is to help the masses realize and take proper account of this experience, to prepare properly for this great downfall, which will show the masses their true leader, the organized urban proletariat. So here he's saying, help the masses realize and take proper account of their experience. Nothing about seizing the leadership. They have to win it by patiently explaining while they're involved beside the mass of workers, soldiers, and peasants in the struggle against the provisional government. So to my last point, you will read anarchist, liberal, and social democrats proving that Luxembourg repudiated the Bolsheviks' role in the revolution in Russia. They praise her opposition to the Bolsheviks' abolition of the Constituent Assembly. It's remarkable, really. Anarchists who profess to oppose all authority, who reject involvement in parliamentary elections, then defend the existence of this bourgeois institution, which the capitalists hope could be a base from which to organise the counter-revolution. Anything, I guess, to paint Lenin as undemocratic. On the other hand, you read articles by the far left which simply claim that Luxembourg enthusiastically supported the Bolsheviks, but it's not very clear if you just cite one lot of quotes, because she actually wrote what they all quote. So we do need to recognise that she actually changed her position. We want to convince people that what we say about her position is what she ended up thinking. And her actual conclusion backs the revolution. Of course, those who think she was against it don't want to admit how she changed her position. So she originally wrote a very hasty and unsympathetic account from jail, but as soon as she was released and could consult reliable sources and was in the thick of the struggle, she overturned all that she'd said. And Clara Zetkin, her close comrade, always insisted that Luxembourg never intended those original remarks to be published. So she wrote frantically to explain that in Germany, the workers' councils had to take power and the National Assembly, i.e. the German version of the Constituent Assembly, had to be opposed. Her passionate words crushed the myth of the so-called Luxembourgist alternative to Lenin. She wrote, the symbol of the new socialist social order is the workers' council. The struggle for the National Assembly is carried on under the war cry of democracy or dictatorship. Even socialist leaders obediently adopt these slogans of counter-revolutionary demagogues. Today, it is not a question of democracy or dictatorship. The question that history has placed on the agenda is bourgeois democracy or socialist democracy? For the dictatorship of the proletariat is democracy in a socialist sense. So now we have a picture which mocks the caricatures that we began with. Luxembourg and Lenin agreed on the process of revolution. The suffering and oppression of the mass of workers provoked spontaneous outbursts by workers demanding reforms. And the role of the vanguard party is to support these struggles and to fight to raise class consciousness and to build the confidence of those involved to challenge every aspect of capitalism. In her introduction to Reform or Revolution, Luxembourg makes a point you will remember Lenin made against the economists. Between social reforms and revolution, there exists for the social democracy an indissoluble tie. The struggle for reforms is its means, the social revolution its aim. But as we've seen, theory is one thing and practice is another. Luxembourg's misjudged attack on Lenin in 1904 indicates an undue influence of Menshevik intellectuals who she later actually despised and who joined the counter-revolution after October 1917. But her openness to their lies indicates that she hadn't grappled with the organisational issues as seriously as Lenin did. And her failure to clearly theorise the role of the party meant that she never drew the need for revolutionaries to be organised with people that they had, theoretical and fundamental agreement with. So she never drew the necessary organisational conclusion from her political arguments against the increasingly right-wing leaders of the SPD. And so when the SPD supported World War I, she hadn't built a revolutionary faction in the party, leave aside whether she should have been in it or not, that could leap into action against the leadership. She had long fought their reformism, so she should have been alert to the need to prepare for such a crisis, but she had no organised force to lead anti-war activity. And Lenin sort of partly refers to some of this in his critique of the Junius pamphlet, which I haven't got time to go into. But also connected to her failure to understand the role of political organisation, there is a theme of fatalism in her thought. And just one example, but there are several throughout her writings. In March 1916, so it's not when she was inexperienced, she wrote to Zetkin, "I place my trust in the objective logic of history, which tirelessly carries out its work of clarification and differentiation." Now, you would never find a quote as so abstract from Lenin. If Lenin could see that things weren't going well, his whole approach was, now, how do revolutionaries get organised and intervene to make the most of this situation? And the KPD under Luxembourg's leadership failed to recruit the vanguard and proved incapable of leading a revolution to victory. So I'm going to finish with a passage by Luxembourg because it's a refutation of the caricatures of both herself and Lenin. She wrote, "The Bolsheviks have shown that they're capable of everything that a genuine revolutionary party can contribute within the limits of historical possibilities. They are not supposed to perform miracles. For a model and faultless proletarian revolution in an isolated land, exhausted by the World War, strangled by imperialism, betrayed by the international proletariat, would be a miracle." And I think what she says next indicates that if she hadn't been murdered by her former party, she could well have learnt from Lenin and Trotsky. It's just possible that then these three eagles of the revolutionary movement would have stood a chance of securing a victory for the German Revolution. Instead of fascism, war, and barbarism, the world may have begun on the road to socialism. Now, I know this is a big may, but this was the only way out of the crisis for the Bolsheviks for all the reasons that she outlined in that last quote. That is the momentous importance of learning the correct lessons from their theory and practice. So Luxembourg goes on, What matters most is to distinguish the essential from the inessential and the core from the incidental in Bolshevik politics. In this last hour, when we are facing the most decisive final struggles all over the world, the most important problem of socialism remains, in effect, the burning question of our time. The proletariat's capacity for action, the masses' strength to act, the will to power of socialism as such. In this, Lenin and Trotsky and their friends were the pioneers who went forth as an example to the proletariat of the world. They are still the only ones to this day who can cry, "I have dared." This is the essential and enduring in Bolshevik politics. In Russia, the problem could only be posed. It could not be resolved in Russia. And in this sense, the future universally belongs to Bolshevism.